This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Count Fosco. We're going to be discussing the art world, funding for the arts, and cultural institutions of the art world. Count Fosco, great having you back on the show.
Thank you, Robert. It's good to be back on.
And I'm also joined here with Pilliter.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Count.
Hey, Pilliter.
Count, do you want to talk about what you do? You're more in a film background.
Well, yeah, I work behind the scenes in different on different sets. As far as film funding goes, Canada is actually pretty good about it. We have lots of different initiatives for that. I've actually talked to some people who are from other places like South America, and they barely have any funding whatsoever. But places like Canada are very good about funding artists. As far as like general principles, you know, I support it. I think artists are very important, even if I don't always agree with them or if I don't like their art. I think it is very important to fund the arts.
What do you think conservatives in general, both mainstream conservatives and the dissident right as well, is generally very hostile towards the idea of funding the arts? I think a lot of it has to do with it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to that they see art as being something that's kind of lefty.
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, like, if you've ever been to any, you know, even networking events, where there are a lot of actors or film photographers, it's like 99% lefty. So I can understand why people who are conservative would have that reaction. I can even understand why boomers and, you know, libertarian types don't want their tax dollars to go to things that they don't agree with or approve of. But at the same time, you know what, I have to defend the general principle of the importance of artists, because they, you know, they inspire us. They give us a reason to think about things, and they basically make things that might be hard for some people to understand more accessible through images, through audio, through things that people can identify with.
Did you listen to that debate I had with Joseph Dobrian? He's a writer about funding the arts.
I did. I listened to like the 5-10 minutes when he basically says to you that it's important to build character to fund your own artistic project. And on an individual level, you know what? I don't have a problem with that. I agree with that. We should be working at things that the market actually wants in order to fund our artistic things that perhaps we have to promote ourselves. But at the same time, I think the system itself should be on the side of the artist. It should be on the side of the creative genius, even if that is it's taking a position of trust rather than a definitive attitude. I don't think there's any sharp divide between the government working for the artist and the artist himself having a cowboy, self-reliant attitude. I don't think these two things have to be in opposition. So, yeah, I would disagree with Dobrian. I don't think these two things need to be separate.
Yeah, because a general conservative argument is one part of it is they see the art world as being left-wing, which culturally they're correct about that, but they, on the economic angle, they have a mentality that everyone has to figure things out on their own. But with the economy, for pretty much you need, for a lot of people, you need a full-time job to cover all your basic needs, and that leaves it maybe a very narrow angle for things like art and writing. So for some people are able to pull it off, but I think subsidizing artists is necessary to produce art subsidizing art in general is necessary. It just depends if it has to be done the right way.
Well, yes, I think part of what we're describing here is what I think the old Marxist used to call petty bourgeois basically people who could afford to be artistic. I mean, I know when back when I didn't have to, you know, pay for things myself, when I didn't have to pay rent and when I didn't have to fund myself, it was very easy to depend on things like a family network, people who had already established themselves, like grandparents, who would basically take care of all those extended needs, which would allow you to have that time, that freedom to explore different things. But not everybody has that, and that's just the thing. There is an inequality between people who have that family network, which is the most important thing, and people who just don't, and as a result don't have the time to, let's say, sit in front of a canvas and ponder what they might produce that would actually benefit people. I think it is right for us to want to have a government working for us and to have tax dollars working for us, rather than to just complain about taxation being theft, which I wouldn't deny, but I also see it as an inevitability. It's inevitable that governments are going to demand that from you.
And then that's the whole kind of argument that the free market always rewards the best art. I mean, going back to a lot of great artists like Van Gogh, pretty much died in poverty. But if you look at, I mean, that's such a fallacy that great artwork is going to be rewarded. If you go to a lot of the most prestigious art galleries in New York or L.A., they're not so much. A lot of the art is actually pretty mediocre. But if you look at a lot of these young up-and-coming artists, a lot of them just have like the right connections to people in the art world, or they come from wealthy families.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like even in my own country of Canada, if you go to places like the Canadian Council for the Arts, or if you go to the Ontario Media Arts Council, these people basically have prizes and they have grants for different demographic groups that they think they need to have these rewards accessible to. It's not even, it doesn't even have to do with what you produce as much as what sort of social background you bring to the table. And this makes, you know, even artists at the bottom very cynical and even very dishonest about what they actually do and how they promote their work. Sometimes, you know, they will put together something that they won't even be aware of what they've done. They'll just put together a package for a grant that they will be certain they'll get because of all the right features they've lined up on it for government funding. It's really sad.
We basically touched on the two key points. One of it is people who are able to succeed as artists or writers or filmmakers because they have the right personal connections. Say someone's a filmmaker and they come from a Hollywood background, or they have wealthy parents who are able to subsidize their career. And the other angle is these government grants, which are given out to these sort of politically correct demographic groups. And you see a lot of, you might see like these art shows that have a sort of politically correct theme, and conservatives resent that, so they have a knee-jerk reaction against the art world. So those are kind of the funding mechanisms of funding the arts. But I think the key is that basically artists should be given basic income to cover their work, and then from there, it kind of evens the playing field, where they're either given a basic grant so they're kind of freed up to devote a significant amount of their time to their work. And also, it's important for them to have gallery space, and then from there, just let the best work kind of rise to the top.
I'll be okay with that. I mean, like, we have versions of that, very, like, limited versions of that in Canada. I mean, like, we have, we actually do spend a huge amount of money on artists here, which, you know, it makes me understand why conservatives are pissed. But at the same time, I think it is the right direction to give that sort of consideration to them. As far as what is being produced, you know, I'm not very impressed with that. I'd probably be happier with the old system of private patrons supporting artists.
What do you think about the whole concept that conservatives and traditionalists have of degenerate art?
I think their motives are good, but what I would say is just because an art form is not easily definable, or if it's surrealistic, doesn't necessarily mean it's degenerate. I think we can find ways to represent things that are inspiring, even if it's not directly meaningful to people. Even the works of David Lynch could be interpreted as degenerate.
You brought up Lynch because I was listening to the podcast with Greg Johnson and John Morgan on Lynch, and their description, I think it was either Greg or John Morgan who said this, their interpretation of Lynch is that he uses the language of the left to critique liberalism. That's how they interpret him. I think that's accurate.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting that Lynch doesn't seem to be what's the word? He doesn't seem to be deliberately pigeonholing anyone. He really I'm sure he'd disagree with this, but there is something kind of idealistic in his surrealism. Even in the way in which he chooses to be surreal about things is very idealistic. Like, everything is perfectly, like, even colors. Like, you know the old trick that Shakespearean playwrights used to do, where they would match up different actors with different colors. So the love interest would be wearing blue, and the boyfriend would also be wearing blue. And even if they would be antagonistic, the audience could kind of tell because of the color code that these two star-crossed antagonists would eventually be lovers. I think Lynch kind of does exactly the same thing in his weird, quasi-autistic way. He really does color code his characters, so we kind of know there's going to be a good ending.
I mean, that's interesting. We're talking about what is paid in the art gallery or the art industry. And it's annoying today because you really can't be a professional musician, artist, blogger. Or it's basically run by a wealthy elite. And if you have a trust fund and go to an Ivy League and you get out of school when you're 22 or 23, chances are you just start your band or start your art or whatever, and then only wealthy people do that. But if you're in a middle or lower class and you try to do something like that, you're just considered a fucking weirdo, and you're basically wasting your life, and you're told you should work with unskilled labor or skilled labor, and doing the arts is a bourgeois thing. I would also say that these degenerate art that's being produced right now is pretty much decadence among the upper class, who's completely bored and everything is an illusion. And so everyone's really a porn actor and actress on stage, and not much good art is being produced. People are just living their lives like it's a teen drama, and America is fetishizing the youth, and the Western world is sickening everyone else. And if there was an answer to this problem of solving the arts, I think, one, we have to all collectively agree that the art institution does not have power over the internet, and that the internet has much more stronger power over that, and there's many different scenes of art that's being produced. And there's this also, again, really bad fetishization over youth culture, which I think is something Western and really pathetic, yet it rules over our lives all the time. And for example, American comic books used to have been like super conservative and traditional and by a team. But now if you go in your comic book aisles today, it's some young douchebag 20-year-old art student and his exotic biracial girlfriend doing real-life adventures of consumption. And they call this postmodernism, and it's really bad, and everybody's producing that. And this same lingo and dialectic is what baby boomers want, and Gen X is just going along, and millennials are fucked with it. And so again, it's good that there's trad artists, because it tells you that no one wants to play the youth fetishization game, and people want to make sincere art, or at least that they want to make art that that the talented or the skilled, if there are some, really do make. I mean, there certainly are skilled and talented, if you don't count Asians, and you actually count decent white people who are like that. And there's a lot of art that's not being produced. And if you invest your time in art, and all of a sudden you're late 20s, and sadly, nobody wants you. And I know I'm being very pessimistic here. But again, the art world is fetishizing these below 26-year-olds and making art with it. And I think this is bad. And I think it shouldn't be age discrimination. I think there should be discrimination of age, and there should be more back to student and sensei, pretty much. I think there needs to be this appreciation in the art world of that degenerate art should have sense. It shouldn't have a shitty left-wing agenda to it. And I think it shouldn't be normie at all. I think it should be its own eccentric niche of people. And I guess that's what I have to say on the whole art world controversy.
Pilliter, what do you think about these artists? Like, there's Trevor Brown, who's a surrealist art. His whole genre is called, I think it's called lowbrow pop surrealism.
Exactly.
Any thoughts on that genre?
Of course. I mean, I grew up with that stuff of lowbrow and pop surrealism. Wherever we're talking about, you know, Frank Kozik, or, you know, the magazine Juxtapose, or the company Kid Robot. I used to collect vinyl toys. I had all that, you know, like the Icebox of Dalek.
Would you say Trevor Brown is considered the most avant-garde and controversial?
Well, once you get, like, really extreme, I think all the lowbrow artists, it's a West Coast scene, and the West Coast does love that White House style of offensive shock art, and that's like the true punk stuff, like Death in June. You know, people love the skull, the Tofen, I forget the name, the you know, Hitlerite skull thing, and people love that whole Death in June aesthetic. But now there's the alt-right. It seems like Death in June already predicted that outcome. But lowbrow, it was really huge during the 90s, 2000s, and sadly it's gone.
Yeah, and I think with Trevor Brown, you can say he's the subject matter. That's open. That's up for debate. But I'd say his work is aesthetically pleasing. Like you, I would say that Trevor Brown's artwork is innovative. I wouldn't say that. So it kind of
I do love Trevor Brown's art, and there's a lot you could say about it. But some other interesting lowbrow art I'm thinking about is Jim Woodring, which I think Woodring, who did the Frank comics and some of his other gym books, he kind of almost, if you think about it, created that whole lowbrow art scene today. Some people would argue that, you know, Rat Fink or that whole rockabilly culture definitely was a part of the creation of lowbrow. But I think, Jim Woodring's Frank comics happened to be one of the early 90s or creation of this new type of comic book, or not comic, but avant-garde art about, you know, 1930s, 20s styles, cartoon characters with psychedelic acid. That kind of what is now really, really popular, Woodring helped promote, and then Kid Robot and Juxtapose kind of fetishized over. But again, I Trevor Brown comes from a more Asian aesthetic, and there's definitely a lot of Asian lowbrow artist.
Count, do you think that if there are given these grants given out or government subsidization of artists, should there be limitations or some form of censorship?
Personally, I have to admit that I would censor certain things, but I wouldn't censor it in a personal way. I would try to give as much relative artistic freedom as possible. Basically, I would censor anything that would be obviously pornographic or, offensive to the public in local areas. But
that kind of gets into a whole debate about, like, what is pornography, what is art. I think Pilliter, we've discussed this. But what, Pilliter, what are your thoughts on the whole controversy with those photographers like Will McBride, Jock Sturgis, and David Hamilton?
Or even Larry Clark with his book Tulsa, which is really popular. I mean, if you think about the old school photography like that, that pretty much created this whole 90s skater West Coast generation of these post-hippiedom but grunge rock. Once again, we're talking about the fetishization of youth between ages 18 to 24. Maybe bicultural people. It's extreme sweppel drug addict culture, and
you're talking about Larry Clark's films.
Yeah, and same with the other photographers as well. It's the aesthetic of this youth thing, and again with the whole lowbrow art. Whether we're talking about, you know, how lowbrow, some of the lowbrow art has influenced that style, but again, this is very similar to. It's more about this culture or this accommodation, and people like art when it has something to do with a real life culture. And it's really annoying and obnoxious like that. It seems to me that people only like artists if it has some significance with some cultural movement, which then influences everybody else. Like, people are now obsessed with Adventure Time. Adventure Time seems to be a post lowbrow cartoon coming from, you know, Fredolator Studios, but it's been 6 years since Adventure Time, but now every single dumb kids cartoon seems to be in the gist of Adventure Time, because the truth is millennials are a pussified, cuddle party, twee, indie rocker, interracial, college educated.
Like something like Trevor Brown is more a product of the 80s to 90s apocalypse culture.
That's right. And today we don't have that apocalypse culture. We have something of a hard twee culture where I think there was a lot of consumption of anime in the 90s. And what was once the evil punk rock stuff, and after the whole SJW invasion, I guess millennials or the Gen X parents told their kids to lighten up and live their life as a happy thing. Instead of thinking about their life as a struggle or having promiscuous degenerate sex or some apocalypse culture shit, most kids today are SJWs with colored hair because they think they're anime, and they think they're some Adventure Time cartoon or some character from Star versus the Forces of Evil. And it's unfortunate that none of these kids know what apocalypse culture, Kid Robot, Juxtapose, Giant Robot, any of those magazines are. There is so much good art. You know, I'm just looking at my library right now. I have old editions of the High Fructose magazine.
So, Pilliter, you prefer pop art to traditional art?
Definitely. I mean, the traditional art is good. And if you want to be conservative and classical, I mean, you could hone your aesthetics that way. But the way I draw is probably digitally. And the way I physically, I've been around cartoons most of my life. And I think of in terms of wackiness. Now, I'm pretty sure I haven't studied or developed the human, you know, figure, but I could at least say that I think cartoons, whether you want to talk from Pepe the Frog to whatever's on the television, is definitely something influential. I just think there's, again, too much of this dumb shit. I mean, I go on Twitter and I favor all these new Asian Aryan artists that are just like white people pretending they're Japanese or just Japanese trying so hard to make white people art. And it's all Tumblr art. It's, what do you want to call it, the new Tumblr chick culture? There's comics like The Lumberjanes, which is pretty much all girls. And it's this new millennial thing that's all, again, pussified twee culture. And I do like twee culture. I just wish it was a little more edgier. And whether you want to say that's some Sarah Silverman-esque philosophy or Margaret Cho philosophy, I think, again, I think there is a good time for shock art to come back. And I think the alt-right has already taken its turns for shock art. And as we said before, it's good to denounce the alt-right at this current moment is because the alt-right is not doing its job of making avant-garde art. It's pretty much just the Def and June fan club turning into the Republican Party. So I guess what we have to do is, again, maybe flirt with alt-left or apocalypse culture or some kind of manifesto. And I'll be working on to a manifesto about apocalypse culture. I plan to write maybe an article.
A book or an essay?
An essay and a declaration and a blog. Focus and a main website, maybe apocalypseculture.com or something like that. I'm going to get back to Adam Parfrey to see if it's okay, because since he made up the term, I don't want to be an endorsement of such. I want to make sure that it's a generic term and influence before I go about this, because as much as I love my Asian Aryan project, I find that it is very important that this is all relative to some kind of traditional apocalypse culture. And that's basically pretty much everyone on the Stark Truth Radio, or these old figures that are now in their 40s of Gen X that need really special attention. And I think there needs to be a further tradition with that.
Count, what are your thoughts on the whole debate about what is art and what is pornography?
Well, I would try to keep a very a stiff definition on that. I think art is something that you actually have to devote attention to. Something that actually has a story with five acts, and pornography usually just has an introduction, and then you have the defloweration afterwards. But
you're saying you can have erotic art. There just has to be a lot of passion put into it. It can't just be like a quick cum shot and that's it.
Well, yeah, exactly. It has to be something that the artist actually plans out and actually puts his own effort into in order for me to be okay, fine, there's something artistic there. It's something stylistic, something that he actually thought about, not something that he planned a weekend with his friends to shoot and then calls it art, but really it's just a jack-off fest.
What do you think about that Rococo painting, Leda and the Swan, if you're familiar with it? Because that's something that's like a traditional Rococo painting, and that would be controversial by today's standards, but it's something, obviously, that has a lot of beauty and aesthetic value to it.
Well, when I type that in, I don't have a problem with it. Yeah, it's nudity, but it's clearly something that the artist actually had to work on.
Oh, yeah. The swan and the lady doing that. Yeah, some very erotic art, that is.
So, Cal, your point is you don't have a problem with erotic art per se. It's more just stuff using porn where there's very little has no aesthetic value to it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't fund something that somebody actually didn't have to do his own planning and thinking on. I actually wanted to bring up another subject. What did Pilliter bring up earlier? Adam Parfrey?
Yes.
Yeah, Adam Parfrey.
Yeah, that sounded very interesting. I was wondering if Pilliter wanted to go into a little bit more about Adam Parfrey. I mean, we're talking about creating our own kind of new comic era. What would there be in Adam Parfrey that is worth considering?
Well, for starters, Parfrey is known for his publishing house, Feral House, and his two books, Apocalypse Culture Volume 1 and 2. When Apocalypse Culture came out, it was basically an offensive culture of just shock art and just about ideals. Because the liberal ideal is that if you're open-minded, you should take every possible thought in your head. But Parfrey, being the eccentric, coming from a family of actors, pretty much took this to the extreme. And the point of his publication house, Feral House, was to publish books from crazy subjects, whatever you want to talk about, Holocaust denial to murder fiction or pedophilia. But especially in the book, for example, Apocalypse Culture 2 has some of the most foundational writers in this culture, which we still have today. some of those artists, some of those writers include Colin Wilson, who unfortunately died a few times back, which I remember Richard Spencer and Andy Nowicki, I remember doing a podcast about him. But he contributed the strange crime of Issei Sagawa about the Japanese cannibal, which the Rolling Stones wrote a song about. He contributed that to a pop culture too. But we also have people like Michael A. Hoffman too, which was Junior, which he wrote about Ted Kaczynski. And then there were, you know, Jim Goad and Peter Sotos, Oswald Spengler and Boyd Rice. You know, people like, even like, again, he'll take up old people you might even not know. And we had, you know, Sean Partridge on the show, but Chip Smith, he also founded Nine Banded Books, which when Feral House became more commercialized and mainstream, Nine Banded took it back to that extreme. But some of the most earliest books that Nine Banded published were part of the alt-right, especially publishing Jonathan Bowden's work and Andy Nowicki and Anster Zinger and, you know, Bradley Smith of Holocaust denial stuff. And again, I think Chip Smith has made a different direction and focused more on eccentric thoughts that you can't really think about.
Well, yeah, the thing about them is they cover the same. They're both a product of the apocalypse culture. Adam Parfrey publishes nonfiction, and Chip Smith's Nine Banded Books just covers fiction novels.
Yeah, and so why these books are important is because most of these people helped create the alt-right, or at least wanted to do a nihilistic kind of, it was post-punk rock, but again, it was very offensive stuff, and having these books made you kind of the eccentric cool kid or the weird book collector, and knowing these fringe topics is interesting. Again, people wanted to hear thought not possible, and we have to make something stable, because what was really offensive in the 90s was saying you're a Nazi. That's dead now, because we have the alt-right, and now it's national news, and we have to move on.
So, Pillator, this kind of ties to back to our previous podcast. But your point was that the alt-right has sort of become like the Republican Party.
Yeah.
It's lost its avant-garde edge.
And Countercurrents is the only publication that's trying to remember its Countercurrents background from James J. O'Mara and, you know, Greg Johnson and some of the authors they have on there. But again, you know, whether you want to call this the ultimate skeptics, but there is a great history of just talking about eccentric and interesting stuff. Now, it should be important that this material, it's very artsy and very criminal and very open-minded, but in no way should it be pretentious. I think being pretentious, especially if young people love to be pretentious, will kind of ruin the movement. There's a lot of shallow, young, dumb kids who will now look at this stuff and think, well, I'm a badass. I read Peter Sotos, or I know about him. But it doesn't, again, they're non-intellectual. You have to make this stuff intellectual and interesting for a certain type of eccentric who understands, you know, whether it be in our in-group of people like, you know, we've had on the show Jamie Stewart of Juju, who knows all this stuff, from people like Sean Partridge. You know, they're in a part of the circle, but the circle has never been open. They've just been shaking hands and liking similar artists from Yukio Mishima.
Back to the original topic, Count, how does funding for, say, film work in Canada? What are the specific qualifications for, say, you want a grant for your film?
Specific qualifications for a grant for your film? Well, that can be very complicated. I remember filling out a grant form with some friends. It can rely on a bunch of things. But if you're not approved and they don't see a reason to include you in any of the festivals, it can still be a kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, handshake type deal in order to even be approved. So, you know, it really depends on what you have to say and where you want your film to be distributed by.
And your point how funding should work is a significant amount of time should go into developing the work. So you're saying would kind of keep out people who say they put in a blank canvas and say and present that as like ironic art.
Well, scientists have done some study on the, what do you call it, the 10,000 hours theory that people like Malcolm Gladwell talk about. And they basically debunk that because every art form is different. But I think that's a good metric. Like, if you can't even put 10,000 hours into your skill, I would be skeptical of your art form.
Count, do you have any particular artists and genres of art that you prefer?
Right now, I'm just kind of enjoying the Pre-Raphaelite style of art. I like a lot of pop art. I like Hegra. I like old comic books. I even like Scott Adams. I've been looking through his old things. I like Schultz. I'm not really as deep into comic type art as Bill Eater is, but I've read a bunch. It's a good way to break into more advanced reading when you're small. But I haven't been really looking into it much lately.
So you're more from the film background than the fine arts. Do you have any?
I work behind the scenes. I do electrical work. I set up sets. I help out constructing staging backgrounds, that sort of thing.
Do you think art should have a specific purpose and definition?
I certainly would. I try to have a. I would basically imitate old themes like the eternal return that we see in a lot of Shakespeare plays, like Macbeth, where you have an assassinated king being replaced by a villain, and the villain in turn being replaced. Basically, that's kind of my modus operandi when I'm writing things. I try to imitate formulas that work.
What do you think about the genre of surrealism? And that can apply to painting or a film like David Lynch.
I think it can be interesting, especially when you draw on surrealism that can mean different things to different people. Like calling things. Labeling things very simply, like the Red Room or something like that, it has an effect on people. People look at that and they interpret it to things in their own lives. Yeah, surrealism can mean something to someone, even if it is fundamentally meaningless.
You've made these online illustrations. I think these are Photoshop. Can you talk about those?
You're talking about like Vaporwave and that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, I made those.
Yeah, I try to put together something that kind of has a meaning to it, but also has like the Vaporwave aesthetic.
What do you think about a movement like, say, Italian Futurism? A big theme of that is a praise of mechanism.
I think it needs to kind of be updated. Like, I like to follow the private space industry. I like watching Bill Whittle's channel, just because he sometimes touches on it because he's an airplane pilot. And I think it would be interesting if we applied that Italian futurism to something like asteroid mining or deep space economic development. It could be funny, maybe a little bit shallow. Maybe liberal, not traditional, not conservative, but I think it would mesh well with that.
So I guess to kind of wrap up the whole art segment, the way the mechanism should work, ideally, is that artists would be given enough funding for room and board, and then given exhibition space, that would kind of even the playing field. And that's sort of the key point about the funding. And as far as qualifications, you would be pretty flexible about what kind of art is shown, from traditional work to modern art. The only two things that you'd exclude are explicit pornography or something that's just no effort is put into it, like a blank canvas. But other than that, you'd be pretty flexible.
I wouldn't be hardcore Stalinist about censoring people. That's true. I do have my own preferences, but I would basically let people produce what they want, even if they're like some kind of hardcore autistic Orthodox Christian at one end, or if they're atheistic National Socialist type at the other end. I would allow them to do whatever they wanted. I would have a very hands-off approach.
Sure. I mean, again, you'll have to make up proxy institutions to fund certain groups that all look out to each other, whether that through Patreon or Kickstarter. It's already happening, basically, but through its own little independent presses. The bigger institutions just are people who want to say this is the norm, but they're failing to do so because they don't have influence anymore, and they're believing in philosophies that denounce them to have any influence because they're basically too weak to do so. So the people who want to uphold society are going to uphold it, and the baby boomers are just going to commit mass suicide by numbers, which is happening now.
Count, before I move on to another topic, is there anything else you'd like to add about art?
Not really. The thing is, whenever I've been to art galleries, aside from art students, it is just baby boomers and that sort who even go there. Usually it's like some gay couple looking at the art on the wall. It's not even really young people who really appreciate that sort of thing. If you paid for my ticket to go to the Vatican to look at the art there, I would enjoy it far more. As far as creating new art, I support it. I've just never seen anything really that interesting.
What about architecture? I mean, architecture is an art form that serves a practical purpose, but what are your thoughts generally on architectural genres?
Well, I find a lot of architecture depends on the actual material that you have to build with. I mean, now we have something being developed called geopolymers, which allows engineers to actually produce material, concrete, that can be very, very, very close to stone and other materials like that. That could be very interesting for developing new forms of architecture. I mean, I'm not an architect, but the kind of the scientific aspect to it is something that I like to read up on.
Well, Robert, you also do art of your own, and it's very interesting because it's definitely pictures of around Santa Barbara. It's pink and blue and purple. And
I've done a whole bunch of different series. I've done a Santa Barbara series, a Vegas series, a San Francisco series, some of London. Count, you've seen my work.
Yeah, I've seen your work. I don't know how you describe it. You use a lot of pinks and yellows, and it's watercolor, right?
No, oils.
Oils, okay. Yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me of you've drawn carousels and things like that.
I don't know if I've done a carousel, but maybe you're thinking of the one I did of the Vegas casino interiors.
That is what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you haven't done any faces, and I find that even just putting one face in a painting can really draw a lot of attention to it.
One of my paintings, actually, I don't know if you've seen that one, but it has faces in it. It also has faces and nudity. That's the one I did of the interior of Caesar's Palace in Vegas from an old photograph from the 60s. Not sure if you've seen that one, but I think that's the only one I have people in it.
Yeah, I wonder if that's like a kind of a deliberate choice, kind of like so that the person can kind of look at it and project himself into the painting. I mean, if there's a face into it, obviously you're not part of it. But if there are no people in it, you can kind of project yourself into the work.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate observation. I mean, I'm generally better at drawing architecture than people, but if it's just the architecture, then it's like your own personal connection with the location.
Well, I said it was pink and blue and pictures of flowers and strange. It's kind of moldy, and it looks like weird beer goggles if you put them on. And if you look back, it looks like one of those impressionist or pixelated paintings. That's how I think of it. It has a lot to do with maybe memorabilia of like 30, 40 years ago. Maybe that kind of alt-left aesthetics of the past, of old materialism. I kind of like that subject as well. Very pretty.
Oh, by that, do you mean like Brandon Adamson's thing?
Yes, absolutely. I there's some of that in there as well.
Actually, as interesting as Brandon Adamson's a painter as well, his work reminds me a lot of Mondrian, if you're familiar with him.
Not really, but yeah, I know what you're talking about, but I've said it's like impressionist or pixelist art, so.
Well, Adamson's work is a lot more minimalistic.
I mean, I do like his squares and robotic pieces, and it's a very interesting, quirky kind of art. I do like it. It's kind of...
Are you talking about his work or the images he uses for his website aesthetic?
No, his actual artwork. Whenever he sells it, has like an art dealer website, you know?
Oh, yeah. You're talking about...
Mm-hmm.
Count, what are your thoughts generally on abstract art?
It's not really my thing. I can appreciate Van Gogh, but as far as I go in modern art, I'm a surrealist guy. Further than that, in terms of what do you call it? Gaga.
Dada.
Dada. That was never me. I can understand futurism, but something, you know, just kind of stretched my imagination a little too well, too much.
Well, surrealism is not traditional, but it's also you need to be able to paint. It's almost photorealistic at the same time.
Yeah.
You appreciate work like Dali?
Oh, absolutely. I love Dali. Dali is something that it feels like a trip. When you're looking at his stuff, you might as well be on drugs. I can absolutely love Dali.
I think to kind of wrap up this segment, I think going back to what I said earlier, it is like the biggest misconception that the best art is rewarded, because different eras in history have a certain type of artwork that is favored. So like going back to the kind of example that Van Gogh today is one of those popular artists, but he died in poverty. I think that goes back to the whole debate I was having, that the best art will automatically be economically rewarded. So
Yeah, absolutely. That's ridiculous. The idea that the best art is economically rewarded via the free market is just completely false, and it's absurd. People have such shallow ways of rewarding things that please them at the moment. And I wouldn't call something great just because it has a dollar amount assigned to it.
So I think, Pilliter, you were showing me this. There's this animated series called Braceface. I think it was made in Canada.
Have you been watching it, Robert?
Perhaps.
How many episodes?
I've lost count.
You've lost count? Have you seen it at all?
Sure, I've seen it.
You're talking about Braceface?
Yes. So
yeah, I watched a few episodes of that.
I've only seen actually one episode of it, and I know for a fact that the main character is basically Alicia Silverstone, voiced by her. And you know, I've only seen one episode about underage drinking. And
oh, that was the one where she goes to Miami to stay with her dad.
Yeah, and then she gets a little tipsy, and with her, she gets drunk. And not many cartoon shows at the time can basically talk about a message of telling your you dumb young kids don't underage drink, but she's a dipsy blonde Jewish girl to do it. So, and she does, whether that's Alicia Silverstone's character or not. But
well, she does kind of base the character on herself, I think, to a degree, because there's like a big theme in there is animal rights. And there's an episode where she becomes vegetarian after getting a job at a meat processing plant.
I haven't seen that episode
yet. That
is
hilarious.
Have you watched? You said you watched a few episodes. Count. How would you describe it?
I watched the one where her boyfriend is kind of giving her the neg, because I watched the one where she dates a 12-year-old.
I saw that one.
I was laughing all the way through that just because of the age difference, and she was shocked that this guy was so so romantic, but he wasn't even a teen.
You know, Bray's face is it's interesting because, you know, it's weird because a lot of these shows are Canadian developed. I think, matter of fact, I think Bray's face is a Canadian developed show, and. Yeah, you know, there's all these other generic cartoon shows that would be on, like, Discovery Kids. Like, I'm thinking, like, Kenny the Shark and Growing Up Creepy. And kind of, like, these bizarre cartoon shows that were not Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network or Disney. But they just happened to be on and were animated. And they were, like, bored of... Like, in a polar opposite universe, Robert, I think you should also watch Kenny the Shark, which was pretty much on the... same Canadian channel, but Kenny the Shark, instead of being IA, it's AA. And
what do you think about her sidekick Maria Wong?
I think it's basically the Jewish hot Jewish girl trying to find having her best non-white kind of white partner in crime who's out on the hunt for Chads, and they're the Chads are on Thought Patrol, and those girls are, but yeah, it's a good duo, you could say, but not in a weird Jewish possessive Elders of the Protocol Zion way, but more of a just look dipsy girls looking to have fun, but again, for their age, it's a very strange, maybe akin to Clueless or some kind of Silverstone movies, but I
do see the comparison to Clueless. I remember watching that kind of anime on something called the Youth Teen Network or something like that. I forget what that was called, but it had a lot of old shows on it, like Redwall. It had cartoons exactly like that, very badly put together.
But what do you think about the general narratives of the show?
I just kind of zoned out. I watched a few episodes, but it's kind of like you'd have to watch it the way a dog watches television, as in you'd have to be emotionally invested in all of her problems. And when I was watching it, I just wasn't. So whenever she had a problem, I was basically just laughing at her.
Well, her lot of problems sound like the ideal of just a girl wanting to get fucked by her hot alpha boyfriend, but...
Well, basically, and I just thought that was ridiculous.
And whether Robert will find that erotic or not, going on the side...
It didn't turn me on. It just kind of made me roll my eyes.
What do you think about how she's visually portrayed? Like how her face is drawn by animators.
Well, she's
kind of triangular list.
Let me tell you what, Robert, this is very similar to a talk of Kenny the Shark, because in Kenny the Shark, we have, an Asian girl in as the main character. And her personality is like the typical West Coast Asian girl that goes after white guys. And I think Alicia Silverstone in Braceface is pretty much the young... Israeli Aryan or blonde Jewish girl that gets off the white studs. So the program could be a way of how to date, get with blonde Jewish girls. So, or Ashkenazi girls. So as dating advice for the non-Jew.
So you're saying that's the premise of the show.
Yeah. If you were a gamer and you wanted to use that the same way you watch Kenny the Shark to understand like what Asian girls think about like white guys. So
Kenny the Shark. I haven't seen that. I have to see that now.
Yeah, that's the polar opposite to Braceface in the AA universe than the IA.
All this lingo is pillaterisms.
Yeah, pillaterism, but IA is a Robert Stark variant spinoff of a pillaterism, but it's all relative. I think, you know, speaking of weird fringe stuff like Braceface, you know, if Robert, if you really want to, you could hypothetically write a long 15,000 word essay about the aesthetics of Braceface and how it could create a new sexuality.
That sounds like something Pillater would do.
No, it sounds like something Robert Stark would do.
You did write a whole article about some, forget which anime it was. It was some anime you wrote a long essay about.
But if you wrote about Braceface and made a long academic essay about it, it could be as well become a part of a apocalypse culture with the right tone and the right terminology.
Oh, you did the one, it was Something Versus the Forces of Evil? Was that the one you did?
Oh, yeah, I did a documentary, a film documentary.
That's what I'm thinking
which
of.
Which I should revise in the future, but it's there, and it's just me looking at stuff and making these weird sexual and AA West Coastisms and trying to understand the deeper. Maybe you should do that with Braceface, and then it could be in the vein of Jonathan Bowden doing the same thing when he would look at old European architecture. But with Braceface, you could put it more edgier, and with the right audience, people will develop this new meme culture around it. Like, anything could be a part of, with the right tone, a part of inner thought that nobody's thinking about. Maybe you can get this Jewish girl who like white guy message across, so...
Well, Robert, I actually do have a question that I'd like to end the show with.
Sure, go ahead.
In terms of the future of the internet and, you know, propagation on it, it seems that big companies are actually looking to censor the main sites like YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Do you think there is any, this is more aimed at the leader, but do you think there is any potential for the rival sites to produce, you know, rival programs? Like, I've been trying out the underground internet .to, I think it's called. And you know, I've opened up accounts on Mines and other companies.
Well, there's
sites.
There's BitChute and VidMe, and they're basically
I've seen those.
They're just websites in case if YouTube takes down your stuff, it's there on the internet. And I should be going on VidMe and putting my stuff over there just in case. I mean, I actually...
Yeah. So it's in case your website's taken down, you have a backup.
Yeah, I mean, I did get a strike for hate speech when I made fun of this Asian-Aryan Muslim and her fan base.
Oh, is this YouTube?
Yeah. And it's a weird case, but she's notorious and everyone hates her, and she's actually being kicked out of Japan, so... I won't reference her name, but she is a little kooky, and she's notoriously known. I don't have to hate her. There's more people that hate her than me, so she is a problem.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Kind of, with the whole free speech angle, I guess this kind of goes back. I want to kind of tie this all back to our original topic of funding the arts. So with the internet, there's this massive censorship of the internet going on. But say if you're an artist who has politically controversial views, there's definitely censorship in the art world. So if you just have this kind of basic social safety net of funding for arts, that wouldn't solve the problem, but it would be somewhat of a backup, somewhat of a cushion, I would say.
It would be helpful if you actually had the government backing you up against corporations that would censor you.
But the whole thing is with these, with things like censorship in the arts, is there's always, no matter what we have, there's always going to be some group in control that sets the narrative. So there's not going to be there's never going to be absolute freedom of expression. But I think the best case scenario is to have relative freedom of expression, but also to make sure to have your own kind of interest looked out for.
Yeah, I'm actually I don't want to sound like Joseph Dobrian, but I'm kind of interested in how we can use the forces of the market to make it harder to censor. Like if you can pitch certain artists in such a way that they don't look controversial, can we kind of use use the market against itself and play off people's worst instincts in such a way that they don't know what to censor anymore.
I mean, that is sort of an element of a shock artist. Shock artists put stuff out there, so they kind of, in a sense, it disrupts the whole narrative that people have.
It blurs the lines almost.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not a shock artist, but it's interesting when you see one and you observe reactions to it. You're not really sure how people are all going to react to it.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Count Fosco for being on. It's been an excellent show. We've covered a lot of really interesting topics.
Thank you, Robert. It's been cool.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you guys, like always.